Border Patrol captivated the nation. 39-year-old Maria Meza was finally admitted into the United States this week with her five children, and their asylum request is now being processed. But this came only after California Congress members Jimmy Gomez and Nanette Barragan intervened on her behalf, camping out with Meza's family and other migrants on the U.S. side of the border near the Otay Mesa port of entry between Tijuana and San Diego, surrounded by metal barriers and border guards and riot gear. The lawmakers were at the border to investigate claims the Trump administration's rejecting asylum seekers at official ports of entry, violating international and national law. California Congressmember Nanette Barragan joins us now from Washington, D.C. She's a member of the House Committee on Homeland Security, just back from the border. Congressmember Barragan, thanks so much for being with us. Describe what you did this past Monday.
Well, I went down to Otay Mesa, which is a port of entry down in Mexico, with one of my colleagues. We were asked to go down to observe as Maria was going to cross and present herself for asylum.
So explain exactly what you did. Democracy Now! Was recently on the border. We saw people for hours, for days, not being let into the U.S. You did something incredible. Somehow you got Maria and her family over the line into the U.S., which is still before the border guards.
Well, it was an interesting thing to see at Otay Mesa. What happens is the U.S., Mexico line actually occurs before you get to a CBP border agent. And so we were able to walk right up to the agent, which crossed over into U.S. territory, where her lawyers were ahead of her and said, we want to present our client for asylum. Now, while they were talking to the CBP officer, Maria, her children, along with eight unaccompanied minors and another male, were able to just walk onto U.S. soil. And so it was an interesting thing because you had a CBP officer about 7 feet into U.S. territory.
So explain what you're demanding now. Not only for Maria, we just got the news that the U.S. is going to send immigrants who are being asylum seekers back to Mexico while they wait, which could take weeks, months, what, years?
Yeah, it's a very dangerous policy to have people waiting in Mexico. If you go down there and you take a look at the conditions, it's not very sanitary. But not only that, people are being searched out. In this case, Maria actually had some of the right ringers were trying to find her. They had to hide her and her family. They had to move her. You can just imagine what it's like. We are also hearing the reports of the two young teenagers that were killed there. Mm-hmm. It's not a situation where you want to put people who are fleeing violence to stay in a place where there is violence and still putting them in danger.
So the investigations of right now, there's a 5-month-old who's in the hospital who is being held by ICE in the freezing cold, what they call ice boxes. And then you have the horror of the story of Jacqueline, the 7-year-old indigenous Guatemalan girl who died in Border Patrol custody. What are you demanding on the Homeland Security Committee in terms of investigations of all of this, Nanette?
Well, we certainly want to investigate the circumstance of what happened. Now, let me tell you, just being at the border with Maria and her children and seeing how CBP responded, I can actually understand now why we are hearing more and more reports of children being ill, of children dying. In our situation, you had Customs and Border Protection officers sitting right there, allowing 3- and 4-year-old children waiting hours on end. In Maria's case, 9 hours in the cold, on the cement. They could go nowhere to eat. They couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom because if they left this little patch of U.S. soil, Mexican immigration officials and police who were on the Mexico line just waiting for them. And so to see the disregard that some of the officers at CBP had for migrants was just disturbing to see and hear. We even had a CBP officer who was talking out loud about how terrible migrants were, how they were coming to commit crime. And so if they have this attitude, they really aren't going to have any regard for human life and their dignity. Now, let me tell you, there are good CBP agents. I represent a port of entry, but there are bad apples, and that's a real issue. So we want to make sure that there is an investigation on what happens. We want to make sure it doesn't happen again. In the case of Jacqueline, we want to also make sure that we put in standards and procedures so that there's a real medical screening. What I understand happened in Jacqueline's case, it could be something as simple as them asking, is everybody okay? That is not what you need to do so that you can make sure and ensure that children are okay.
I want to ask you to stay with us so we can do part two of this discussion.
I believe they would have seen that she was not well and would have got medical attention much sooner. My colleague, Dr. Raul Ruiz, who is...
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Thanks so much, Congressmember Nanette Barragan, just back from the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland, the time is 5:06 and 14 seconds. I'm Aiden Moyer, and up next is our evening news with Rachel and Linda. Stay tuned.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
What should be before that?
He can't hear you through the mic.
There's a pullback on SNAP benefits.
And in international news, 3 Palestinian protesters were killed.
American children ages 8 and 15. On Tuesday, Michael Amatolo was arrested for hate crime charges after he threatened to kill two African-American children. The 8-year-old was taking out the trash when his neighbor Amatolo started yelling racial slurs at him. The youngster's older brother came to his rescue when he saw that Michael Amatolo was wielding a butcher's knife about 6 feet away from them and yelling that he was going to kill them. The two children called police immediately. Upon his arrest, Michael Amatolo continued to yell racist remarks at police officers. Amatolo was released Tuesday and is now facing new allegations for threatening the family after making bail, says Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
On Wednesday, Nathan Schrader, a 35-year-old man, was arrested by local police officers who were attacking someone with a hatchet in downtown Portland. Jason
Renaud with the Mental Health Association of Portland tells that, and quote, almost everyone who's arrested is drunk, loaded, or mentally ill. Portland's in the midst of a mental health crisis, and we're really at a loss as to what to do about it. Mental illness is challenging, and coupled with economic instability, can limit critical resources like cost-friendly medication, therapy, anger management, and more. Renaud says that there are not enough organizations assisting homeless people with mental illness, and this is why Schrader will end up in jail. According to the Department of Corrections Health Services, all inmates in Oregon are screened for mental illness by psychiatrists and administered pills for their mental health. Short-term services are also available to inmates who are suicidal or experiencing other emotional distress. 14% of all homeless people suffering from serious mental illness or substance abuse disorder. 72% are living in unsheltered locations. Veterans have a 36% likelihood to experience chronic homelessness. If you want to help someone in need or suffering from homelessness, please consider donating or volunteering at Join PDX. You can find Join at joinpdx.com.
A fierce windstorm brought down trees and power lines in western Washington. About 150,000 homes and businesses lost power as winds gusted to 70 miles per hour. Many roads were closed as trees and power line damage made some spots impassable. This comes just days after a tornado struck the town of Port Orchard in western Washington. Water was getting into people's homes on Three Crabs Road, forcing residents to evacuate. North of Seattle, Interstate 5 was closed this afternoon when downed power lines blocked the freeway near Burlington, according to the Associated Press. About 75 miles north of Seattle, downed trees and power lines forced the Washington State Department of Transportation to close the Deception Pass Bridge in Oak Harbor. Many schools were closed, including Winlock School District in Lewis County, to a power outage. Even the National Weather Service office in Seattle was itself struggling to stay on the air. The forecasters there tweeted that they were depending on backup generator power after the storm knocked out their power. About 300 flights were delayed from Seattle Tacoma International Airport, and the wind ripped off part of a St. Joseph clock tower in Bellingham. Luckily, there have not been any reports yet of injuries. Gusty winds are expected to continue through tonight.
Great whales are on the move south this December. So, the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department is celebrating the migration with the annual Whale Watching Week, December 27th through the 31st. Volunteers from the Whale Watching Spoken Here program will be at 24 sites along the Oregon coast during the event. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. each day, they'll offer whale watching tips and facts about the animals. You can find a map of the whale watch sites on the website whalespoken.org. Every winter, about 20,000 gray whales migrate south from Alaska to the warm calving lagoons of the coast of Baja, Mexico. Whale Watching Week coincides with the highest frequency of whales swimming down the coast. About 30 whales pass by per hour. Luke Parsons, an OPRD ranger with the Whale Watching Center, says the goal is to create awareness and compassion for whales and other marine life. And, quote, whales are a special part of the Oregon coast, said Parsons. We're very proud to work with our volunteers to help visitors connect with the whales and our oceans.
President Trump, again directing national policy by Twitter, announced the departure of his defense secretary this afternoon. Trump's message said, quote, General Jim Mattis will be retiring with distinction at the end of February after having served my administration as secretary of defense for the past 2 years. Excuse me. Mattis was known for more of a steady hand in maintaining U.S. foreign policy, and his departure opens speculation as to whether some more hardline policies will follow after he leaves in February. The Washington Post wrote that Mattis again and again moved to reassure allies unnerved by Trump's unpredictable pronouncements and argued successfully for continued U.S. commitment in Syria, Afghanistan, and other places where military leaders see an ongoing threat, end quote. With the pending withdrawal of U.S. troops in Syria in the news, Mattis leaving may mean that Trump intends to focus less on Iran's oil and manufacturing as a threat to regional profits. In a letter to the president, General Mattis said, quote, because you have the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects, I believe it is right for me to step down from my position, end quote. In an apparent rebuke to Trump's international abrasiveness, Mattis also said, quote, one core belief I have always held is that our strength as a nation is inextricably linked to the strength of our unique and comprehensive system of alliances and partnerships. We cannot protect our interests without maintaining strong alliances and showing respect to those allies, end quote.
A week after 7-year-old Jacqueline Cal McQueen died of dehydration in Border Patrol custody, the Trump administration is trying to make things harder for refugees. Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen said today that the Trump administration will force certain asylum seekers to remain in Mexico during the course of their asylum hearings. End quote. Aliens trying to game the system to get into our country illegally will no longer be able to disappear into the United States, where many skip their court dates, end quote. She said, following the Trump administration's rhetoric painting refugees as sneaks. End quote. Instead, she said, they will wait for an immigration court decision while they are in Mexico. Nielsen is expected to face a grilling from the Congress over the death of this young girl. And the Trump anti-immigrant program took a blow from the courts yesterday as the U.S. Justice Department struck down a guidance statement from former Attorney General Jeff Sessions that denied the possibility of asylum to people escaping domestic violence. Judge Emmett Sullivan of the U.S. District Court for D.C. calling Sessions' rule, end quote, horrible, said the, end quote, the new credible fear policies are arbitrary, capricious, and in violation of the immigration laws. Meanwhile, the president has pressed Congress to provide $5 billion for a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border, but a measure passed in the Senate Wednesday, keeping the funds flat, and only devotes $1.3 billion to barriers. As of this writing, it was unclear whether the U.S. government would effectively be shut down over this dispute with the lack of temporary spending measures. In related news, a report from the International Monetary Fund that a 1 percentage point increase in the share of migrants in the adult population, end quote, increases GPD per person in advanced economies by up to 2% in the longer term.
And now time for our news midheads.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. At 6, it's Sojourner Truth. Then at 7, the struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy, low or 36 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be a high of 44 degrees, low of 42 degrees with 100% chance of rain. Today in history marks the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, the first manned mission to the moon. The crew were the first to leave low Earth orbit, reach the moon, orbit it, and safely return back to Earth. The quote of the day is from Jimi Hendrix, quote, I wish they had had electric guitars in cotton fields back in the good old days. A whole lot of things would have been straightened out, end quote. Thank you.
Connections is a daily module that moves climate change away from debate and focuses on how it's impacting listeners' lives. The features report on what diverse people and organizations are doing to reduce the associated risks and connects the dots between climate change and energy, public health, extreme weather, food, water, jobs, and the economy, national security, and more.
And this is Climate Connections. When your plane lands and you're late for a connecting flight, waiting to taxi to the gate is frustrating. And it's not just a problem for travelers. When a plane waits on the tarmac, it's wasting fuel. But at the Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, planes have a route to taxi around instead of across busy runways, so they can go directly to the gate.
So there's a huge fuel savings, it's a delay reduction, and there's a climate benefit to that.
It's just one of many changes at the airport that makes sustainability planner Polly Sattler proud. By donating surplus food to a local group, the airport keeps waste out of the landfill, which reduces methane pollution. And energy-efficient LEDs now light the runways and parking decks. These long-lasting bulbs do not need to be replaced as often.
It's a reduction in our utility bills, but it's also a reduction in our labor costs.
So even though many of these efforts are good for the climate,
we don't necessarily talk about the greenhouse gas emissions or climate change.
Because the improvements are great for the bottom line. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Activist Melissa McInnes, a Ferguson activist, has made an official statement for her son's brutal death. 24-year-old Donye Jones was found murdered. These next accounts are very gruesome. Please take note of this as a trigger warning. Donye Jones was found dead. His cause was specified as lynching in front of his own home. Graphic photos were shared through social media from Jones' family who found him. Melissa McInnes stated, and quote, "They lynched my baby. I'm sick and losing my mind, but I had to let the world know what they did to my baby," end quote. Some activists have said that this account of a mother finding her son dead from a gruesome death reminds many of the death of Emmett Till. The NAACP stated, quote, "The St. Louis County NAACP is joining the McInnes family in the call for transparency and justice regarding the murder of Donye Jones. There's too many unanswered questions, and we are demanding answers to. We support Mrs. McInnes' call for justice and transparency in the death of her son," end quote. McInnes has also said she believes her son is dead due to her activism, and we here at KABU only hope that this act of violence gives indication that we need to continue to fight for Black lives.
Nonprofits are the topic of discussion in this week's Money Matters. Be sure to have a critical mind when tuning in. It may start a conversation.
My name's Mark Cunaberti. Welcome to another edition of Your Money Matters. I hate to say it, but nonprofits and government agencies just aren't run as well as for-profit businesses. The infamous FUPAs like Amtrak and the U.S. Post Office are well known for their inefficiencies and their propensity to burn money with little payback. But anyone dealing with nonprofits or government agencies also know all too well on occasion they just can't get out of their own way. That's not to say all nonprofits are buffoon-manned or that problematical entities can't get better at what they do. The California Department of Motor Vehicles, which we know as the DMV when I was growing up, was a nightmare compared to a life sentence on Alcatraz in its heyday. Having to go to the DMV wasn't much of an improvement. Lines were long and the employees didn't care about making them shorter. Paperwork was nightmarish. Decades later, the DMV has improved, although the paperwork is worse. Paper seems to be the in thing at the DMV and indeed most other government agencies. I find most government agencies lacking, however. The employees seem throwbacks to the DMV of old, and needless to say, expediency is a long-forgotten word. From the federal government to the local township, It seems normally intelligent people turn into zombies once taking a seat at the public pulpit, from overspending their budgets to ridiculous hoops they make people jump through. Bureaucracy has its bright moments, but they are obscured by many moments of darkness, doom, and gloom, as those having to put up with and get processed through these entities lose a little bit of themselves each time, and even more of their wallet before coming out the other end. Nonprofits, unfortunately, do little better. I've worked for and been on the board of many of nonprofits. In fact, my radio show is carried by a nonprofit, so I hope they don't take this too seriously. But seriously, folks, the nonprofits and the governments don't have the most important element that refines efficiency in a for-profit endeavor, mainly the incentive to turn a profit. And profit being the end-all and be-all of capitalism, one could say nonprofits and government agencies are not capitalistic entities. And drawing one more step from there, one could say that government agencies and nonprofits are the perfect example of what life would be like in a non-capitalistic economy. Without the incentive to turn a profit, or better said, the threat of job loss if one doesn't, the entity limps along with mediocre services or products, as no one employed there is really under the gun to perform up to the standards of what a for-profit business would have to accomplish to survive. Government employees are very rarely fired, and when they do, there's lots of lawsuits, and nonprofits usually have non-paid people. So who wants to fire a non-paid person, right? Nonprofits, for their revenue, depend a lot on donation, a capital infusion that is not product or service competitive. Their monies come from grants, fundraisers, and pledgers, who, for the most part, do so out of the good of their heart and not necessarily because of the price or quality. That being said, the quality can be, and in many cases is, superior or as good as a for-profit business. After all, nonprofits serve part of a community need that a for-profit company might not undertake because there's no money in it. The point here is not to debate the services nonprofits or government agencies provide. Indeed, most provide much-needed services. The illustration points to how well and how efficiently they provide that service, and in most cases, the inefficiencies are legendary and ongoing. Nonprofits notoriously operate within thin margins, if not continually in the red and struggling. Government agencies have the funding of government printing presses, so they can essentially burn money, and most of them do. In conclusion, there are those that call for a knife in the heart of a capitalistic economy, and some push for some sort of socialistic ideal to replace it. But in this analyst's opinion, to do so would have to go to a DMV-like office that has the accounting losses of an Amtrak for almost everything you would need in daily life. And the thought of that, folks, makes a stay in Alcatraz seem only half as bad. That does it for today's edition of Money Matters. Please remember, discussions of the newscast should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff members, or underwriters. Our website is moneymanagementradio.com, where everything is free. My name is Mark Cunningham.
Today's report, and now it's time from today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll have to get
a bill that would have granted federal recognition to the Little Shell Tribe in Montana failed, Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports.
Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, objected to fast-tracking the bill's passage in the Senate Thursday. The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians Restoration Act of 2017 would have created a government-to-government relationship between the United States and the Little Shell Tribe. In his singular objection to a call to bypass debate and pass the bill, Senator Lee pointed to the Bureau of Indian Affairs' denial of the Little Shell's petition for federal recognition in 2009.
And I'm aware of no legal analysis indicating that the conclusion of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 2009 was inadequate or flawed. For that reason, I object.
Little Shell Tribal Chairman Gerald Gray says Lee is referencing an outdated decision.
We'd sued on that, and we won. That ruling doesn't even exist anymore, but he pulled it out of
from archives.
Gray called Thursday's vote a disheartening outcome and thanked Montana's Representative Greg Gianforte and Senators Steve Daines and John Tester for carrying the tribe's recognition legislation. Speaking ahead of the Senate vote Thursday, Daines, a Republican, reiterated the bill's bipartisan support.
The Little Shell tribe has waited for lifetimes. They should not have to wait another year to get this done.
It is unlikely the bill will come up for a vote before the end of the congressional session and will therefore need to be reintroduced next year. I'm Nikki Ouellette.
Congress voted Thursday to update a law governing the transfer of lands allotted to five Oklahoma tribes. As Caroline Halter reports, amendments could help families hold on to land.
The amendments eliminate the law's blood quantum requirement for people inheriting restricted status land. That's privately owned land under tribal jurisdiction exempt from state taxes.
As it stands right now, if you are less than one half blood quantum of the five tribes, so if I am less than one half Cherokee, when that land passes from my parents to me, it falls out of restricted status. It just becomes another piece of Oklahoma.
That's Sarah Hill of the Cherokee Nation. She says the 1947 Stigler Act led to the gradual loss of most restricted lands in Oklahoma, and that was the intention.
So the purpose of the law was to take land out of restricted status and get it onto the tax rolls. They're trying to eliminate the tribes. There's no other tribe in the country where blood quantum determines whether or not that land is still considered Indian land.
The amendments passed the House and Senate and are expected to be signed by the president.
That was Caroline Halter. The federal government is failing to meet its obligations to tribes, according to a new report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Since colonization, the U.S. government has signed off on nearly 400 treaties with the First Nations, offering services in exchange for acquiring their lands. But the commission says there remain continued spending shortfalls in areas vital to tribal communities. In a conference call, Catherine Lehman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights said basic infrastructure needs are greatly lacking on reservations.
An estimated 14% of households in Indian country have no access to electricity. At a rate 10 times higher than the national average.
Cheryl Kennedy is chairwoman of Oregon's Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. She agrees with the report's other finding that health care funding is below the national average. In 2017, Indian health services spending per patient was nearly a third of that for the rest of the U.S.
And then you wonder why the health disparities for Native Americans are at